Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Peter Husey, and I'm Director of Strategic Deterrent Studies at the Mitchell Institute for Aerospace Studies, and I want to welcome you to our nuclear deterrent series. We are very pleased this morning to have Dr. Mark Schneider, who is joining us today. Dr. Schneider is a senior analyst at the National Institute for Public Policy, where he specializes in missile defense policy, nuclear weapons, arms control verification, and compliance. He previously served in a number of senior positions within the Office of the Secretary of Defense and has chaired several working groups of the START and INF Treaty Implementation Commissions. Welcome back, Dr. Schneider, and thank you for taking the time to join us today. I would now like to turn it over to you for some opening remarks.
Thank you. I'm going to be filling in today for Dr. Steve Blank. By the way, anything I say about Russian nuclear doctrine, including the new aspects, you can find in his publications 10 or 20 years ago. He is a national asset. Anyway, we are in a very interesting period in the classic sense of the word, that if you're living in interesting times, your life expectancy might not be too high. We have found out, we got a very limited taste of what a WMD war would be like when we got hit by COVID-19. And that's not even a real biological weapon. And it gives you some idea what the effect of WMD weapons can have on our society. Russia is a nation that has a rather unique nuclear doctrine. It has, in all probability, the lowest nuclear weapons use threshold in the world, and that may even be declining. In 2020, we got a lot of confirmation of our worst fears about Russian nuclear doctrine. In June 2020, President Putin signed and made public a decree on nuclear deterrence. That decree confirmed some of the most alarming aspects of unofficial Russian press reports, including reports in state media about what they're planning to do with regard to nuclear weapons. As distinguished Russian journalist Pavel Feldengauer pointed out last year, quote, the Kremlin is constantly playing the deterrence game by trying to scare the West, but the situation has two dangerous ramifications. First, the nuclear threshold is becoming lower. In any serious skirmish, the Russian Navy would either have to go nuclear or risk being sunk. And second, the Russian leadership believes it has surpassed the West militarily thanks to its dazzling super weapons. And of course, these are all nuclear or nuclear capable. Moscow's threshold of the employment of military force in conflict situations may also drop further. It's now clear that as I mentioned, the press reports about very low Russian nuclear weapons use threshold are accurate, because they're in paragraph 19 of Putin's decree. He lists four conditions for the use of first use of nuclear weapons. The first of these is launch of ballistic missiles against Russia or its allies. The second is the use of nuclear weapons or any type of mass destruction against Russian Federation or its allies. The third is an attack by an adversary on critical government or military sites of the Russian Federation, the disruption of which would undermine nuclear forces' response actions. Fourth, aggression against the Russian Federation by the use of conventional weapons when the very existence of the state was in jeopardy. Until the publication of this document, the number D, existence of the state formulation was supposedly their nuclear doctrine. This was routinely contradicted in Russian media, including state media. And it turned out that these reports were unfortunately very much on the mark. There are a number of very threatening aspects in paragraph 19 of the decree. First, Pavel Falkengauer says that in reality, it could mean a nuclear response to a single ballistic missile launch against Russia before the Russians knew whether it was nuclear or non-nuclear. The second was they changed the formulation relating to chemical and biological attack to weapons of mass destruction, which is much broader and could involve many other things. Third, the formulation of attacks that would disrupt their nuclear forces and command and control is very significant, because they didn't say strategic nuclear forces, they said nuclear forces. And since everything is dual capable in Russia, basically that can be read as saying you hit any type of Russian military base, you're disrupting their nuclear forces, because they have nuclear capable systems at every level in their military. So that is quite disturbing. I think the intent of the formulation here is to try to deter a U.S. conventional attack on anything in Russia other than along the border in the event of a war, which means a Russian attack on one of the NATO states. And if they succeed in preventing us from waging a serious conventional response against a Russian invasion of NATO territory, we're going to lose the war. So we now have a much better understanding, undeniable really, of what Russian nuclear doctrine is about. It's one other interesting thing in the doctrinal document. It talks about using nuclear weapons when sovereignty or territorial integrity of Russia is threatened. Those are pretty ambiguous concepts. So when you take a look at what Putin has said over the years about what threatens Russian sovereignty, it's some pretty minor things. I mean, a bad editorial in a major Russian publication is, in his view, a threat to Russian sovereignty. Now, I'm not suggesting he would nuke us in response to a New York Times editorial, but he certainly has a very low threshold for nuclear first use. Certainly, Russia, there was a lot of talk in Moscow today about preemptive attacks against NATO. And that's very interesting. A couple of years ago, a interesting study by Harvard, the Belfer Center, looked at Military Thought, which is the official journal of the Russian defense or general staff. They found at least 18 articles in this publication advocating preemption against NATO. That's a very, very important document. Now, Putin himself in 2015 made a rather remarkable statement. Basically, he linked nuclear strategy to the tactics of street fighting. And this is a direct quote out of Putin's speech to the Valde Forum, which is a international economics forum. He said, 50 years ago, I learned one rule on the streets of Leningrad. It is, if a fight is inevitable, be the first to strike. And I think that's pretty much his nuclear doctrine. Dr. Steve Blank, about 20 years ago, noted that, quote, essentially, there is no clear fire break between conventional and nuclear scenarios in Russian open sources. And I think he was absolutely correct. Central to Russian nuclear strategy is the concept of escalate to de-escalate, or more accurately, escalate to win. This goes back officially to 2003 in a document published by the Russian Defense Ministry. I believe it actually dates from the earliest Putin doctrinal statement in 1999. Again, as Dr. Blank wrote, arguably, escalation dominance is merely a part of a much broader nuclear strategy that relies heavily on the psychological and the intimidating composition, component of nuclear weapons. In 2017, the Director of Defense Nuclear Agency said, we see them routinely practicing escalate to de-escalate in their military exercises. I think there's no question about that. Just about every major nuclear, every major military exercise conducted in Russia over the last 2 decades is reportedly goes nuclear at the end. So we have a doctrine which is disturbing, to say the least. If I had to sum it up in a single sentence, would be they'll use nuclear weapons anytime there's a major conflict and they think it's in their national interest. From a deterrence standpoint, it's our job to make sure they don't think it's in their national interest to do this. And that's critically important in light of the possible consequences of the introduction of nuclear weapons into to warfare. We have no official U.S. government statement on the estimated number of Russian nuclear weapons, total number. I think it's clear that it is much larger than our own. In December 2019, the head of the Russian ICBM force said that they had reduced their strategic nuclear forces by two-thirds from the end of the Cold War. That contrasts dramatically with the previous Russian statements claiming an 85% reduction. The effect of this is, if you do the math and you get their estimates of or their statements about the size of the Soviet strategic nuclear forces, and you see you see this in the original Star Treaty database, it means they've got over 3,300 deployed nuclear warheads right now. We certainly have in the last year a lot of very interesting statements about the size of their capability, some of them by U.S. government officials. For example, less than a month ago, General Hyten, Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said they have thousands of low-yield nuclear weapons, both strategic and tactical. That confirms, more or less anyway, a significant number of reports about the scale of Russian low-yield nuclear weapons production. He stated that we have to deter this with our much smaller low-yield force, and it is certainly much smaller. No question about that. The nuclear low-yield Trident. There hasn't been any formal release of a number. Hans Christensen and Matt Corbett, the Federation of American Scientists, say we've got under 25, and we're talking about thousands on the Russian. On the Russian side. So that's an alarming comparison. There is other evidence of large-scale Russian production of nuclear weapons. The 2019 Director of Defense Intelligence Agency said they had actually increased recently their nuclear weapons production capability to thousands per year. In light of the US Pitt facility, scheduled for about 2030, we're going to build up to 80 a year. So there's a massive disparity there. Rather amazingly, earlier this week, a German publication got a hold of a German Defense Ministry document, which said that the Russians had 6,375 operational nuclear warheads. That apparently is significantly higher than the threat level that was assumed in the 2018 U.S. nuclear posture review. Bill Gertz has stated in a number of publications that Russia is in the process of increasing its nuclear forces. They're going to build up to 8,000 nuclear warheads by 2026. And in 2019, Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Nuclear Matters, a Rear Admiral retired Peter Fanta, confirmed the 8,000 number as their goal. It is clear that their force is several times larger than us. To quote Hans Christensen and Matt Korba, Federation of American Scientists, and I don't think you can accuse either one of them as likely to understate our nuclear capability. They say we've got 1,800 deployed warheads, 1,400 on strategic missiles, and 300 bomber bases, and 100 non-strategic nuclear weapons at our bases in Europe. That total under 2,000. So we're talking about several to one existing Russian lead, and it's almost certainly going to increase in over the next decade. Russia is modernizing its strategic forces. 1997 was an interesting year. The last U.S. Strategic System Legacy Cold War B-2 bomber entered the U.S. inventory. Since that time, as a matter of fact, in 1997, the Russians began to deploy the first version of the new SS-27 Mod 1, or they call it the Topo M Variant 2 system. And since that time, they have officially announced, or in some cases, the defense industry announced for them, having gotten contracts for somewhere between 20 and 25 strategic new strategic nuclear weapons. A few of them are updates of Cold War systems, but almost all of them are completely new systems. That's an amazing situation to be in. STRATCOM Commander Admiral Charles Richards in February wrote an article in Naval Institute Proceedings where he summarized what their strategic nuclear programs are. And what he said was the strategic capabilities of our competitors continue to grow, and they are sobering. More than a decade ago, Russia began aggressively modernizing its nuclear forces, including the non-treaty accountable medium and short-range systems. It's modernizing bombers, intercontinental ballistic missiles, submarine-launched ballistic missiles, nuclear-powered ballistic missile submarines, warning systems, command and control capabilities, and the doctrine to underpin their employment. In short, its entire strategic force structure. This modernization is about 70% complete and on track to be fully completed within a few years. In addition, Russia is building new and novel systems like hypersonic glide vehicles, nuclear armed and nuclear powered torpedoes, cruise missiles, and other capabilities. He's talking about things that have already happened. There are a whole bunch of things, of course, that they're doing that haven't quite happened yet. In December 2020, Russian Defense Minister General of the Army, Sergei Shoigu, said they had modernized 86% of their strategic nuclear forces, and they'd would reach 88.3% this year. The difference between Admiral Richards' 70% and Shoigu's 86% doesn't appear to be substantive. It appears to be definitional. The Russians count the Delta IV submarines with their new Sinova and Liner missiles as modern systems, and we don't. But however you define modern systems, the U.S. number is right now, unfortunately, zero. Russia is has announced in December 2019 it will complete its modernization of its strategic forces in 2024. Now, I want to make sure you understand that their dates are based on best case assumptions. You slip them, every one of them, a year or two, you probably be get the right ones. But certainly, they're going to complete the modernization of their entire strategic nuclear force before we even begin ours. And another fact you really got to keep in mind is it's not that modernization goes on, they replace the Cold War legacy systems, they get the new ones, and then they stop for the next few decades. They modernize and then modernize the modernized systems and then introduce new systems to replace the new and modernized systems. And that's what they're doing. As a matter of fact, in December 2020, the commander of the strategic missile forces said that within the short and midterm, they're going to start on several new ICBM projects. And, you know, we're debating whether we go ahead with one. They've already fielded three newer modified ICBMs. They're, according to them, on the verge of introducing the Sarmat heavy ICBM in 2022. I would slip that a couple years, but that will certainly come along. And their announced program involves a massive deployment of that, something that can't possibly fit into any arms control regime. So we are facing a major and growing nuclear threat. There are at least six announced programs right now. They have at least six hypersonic missile programs ranging from 1,000 to kilometers to full ICBM ranges. They're all nuclear armed, they're nuclear capable, and there are probably more coming. As a matter of fact, they've announced that newer types are going to be built. So we are facing a rapidly growing threat there. It's not, some of these are clearly strategic. For a number of them, whether you call them non-strategic or strategic is rather arbitrary because it depends on what platform you put them on. They're gonna put them on surface ships, submarines, and bombers of all types, including new types of bombers. So we're going to face a major threat here. And they're actually hinting very strongly about using the hypersonic missiles for preemptive strikes against the U.S. National Command Authority. Putin himself made a veiled threat about this, and it was a not very veiled threat by the chief of their general staff in 2019. So we are facing that. The non-strategic force, it is massive because of the increasing ranges here of the non-strategic weapons, up to now 4,000 kilometers. Whether you classify some of these as strategic or non-strategic, it's pretty arbitrary. They can do both of the missions. Official U.S. number is 2,000 and growing. I believe, based on Russian sources, Russian government statements, and a variety of other sources, that it's over 5,000. Very recently, Sergei Rogov, a very noted Russian expert on this, and a moderate by Russian standards, says they've got somewhere between 3,000 and 10,000 non-strategic nuclear weapons. And it's basically the entire Cold War inventory of weapons with updated capabilities. And we've got, by comparison, nothing. We've got, according to Korba, 100 gravity bombs deployed in Europe. We have a program underway for a nuclear SLICM, but it doesn't even have an official IOC date as far as I can determine right now. So they're going to have a major advantage for a long, long time to come. Bottom line conclusions on this, the impact for deterrence, nuclear deterrence is absolutely critical. The consequences for the failure of deterrence can make the COVID-19 epidemic look like a tea party. Russia, I believe, will initiate nuclear attacks in any major conflict when they see it in their interests, and we have to make sure they don't see it in their interests. And minimum deterrence is not a way to do that. I think we have been sort of sleepwalking toward minimum deterrence for a long time. That will dramatically, if that continues, it will dramatically increase the risk of war and nuclear escalation, and it's not going to be an American president who pulls the trigger. The modernization of our forces are critical. We're at a situation now that they're so old that we either modernize them, replace them with new systems, or we lose the deterrent capability. Haven't tested nuclear weapons in 20 years, and the Russians have. That's a major asymmetry in and of itself. Until the announcement of the Mark 93 program for a new type of nuclear weapon, we hadn't done anything in over three decades. That's a very critical program that should continue. We have to take the Russian threat very seriously, as our leaders Pentagon leaders have now said for many years, and we need a deterrent. Numbers are important too, and we need to maximize deterrence because of the consequences of the failure of deterrence. We don't want to find out whether you can fight a limited nuclear war. And Putin is just the person to try to start a limited nuclear war, particularly one where they assume, and this is all over the doctrinal literature, that they can use nuclear weapons first and we won't respond. That's a really bad perception, and is one that we should do everything we can to change. And literally in the last 2 years, we've begun to do that. We've conducted exercises of a type we haven't done since the Cold War, and exercises of the type that the Russians have done consistently through the post-Cold War period. So we're beginning to send signals, the right signals. I hope that continues. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mark. And I'm going to go to a couple questions. Now, you have mentioned the extent of Russia's nuclear modernization. Let's go to a point that you and Steve historically have talked about, is what do the Russians want to do with the new modernization that they're doing? What are their geopolitical ambitions that they believe these nuclear weapons will give them the ability to do?
They see nuclear weapons as not only deterrent assets, but major warfighting assets. Clearly, the scope of their programs is much more than deterrence. The large introduction of low yield, very low yield nuclear weapons is very stark evidence of that. And fortunately, now we have official U.S. Confirmation that the press reports we were seeing in Russia and some in the United States were accurate on the scale of their capabilities. They make no secret that they want to dominate former Soviet space, and they clearly want to also dominate Western Europe to the extent that they can. Now, you're dealing with a nation which has a gross national product roughly the same size as Spain and Italy that wants to be perceived as a superpower. Well, you don't have the economic power to do that. You've got a large army by Western standards today, but not nearly big enough to conquer NATO. But you have a nuclear capability which vastly exceeds, probably anyway, the rest of the world combined. And that's the temptation to use this. And when you throw in classic Russian paranoia, and Putin is extremely paranoid, and at the same time, he regards Russia, you know, historic Russian imperialism going back to the Tsarist period as completely legitimate. And you put that together with you know, nuclear weapons and a low nuclear weapons use threshold, that I think it's pretty pretty threatening. And as I say, it's our job to prevent him from ever believing he can win a war. That means preventing him from believing that his escalate to de-escalate or escalate to win strategy is going to work. That's a very important objective. And to do that, you're going to have to put some serious resources in rebuilding our nuclear deterrent capability. In some respects, it's literally at the point of collapse. The nuclear weapons production complex, some elements of it go back to the Manhattan Project, which is literally amazing. The Russian nuclear production complex is fully functional and, according to the director of DIA, can produce thousands of nuclear weapons a year, new types. And they have developed new types. They've said that the weapons that they're developing for the new nuclear weapons are new types. They improved military capabilities. And there are many, many reports that they're developing very advanced nuclear weapons, very low collateral damage, very low fission products. We're not doing any of that. We haven't done any of that in over 30 years. And that's pretty disturbing, quite frankly.
Let me ask you a question that I was going to ask anyway, but it also in the Q&A, some of our participants have asked. There are those who advocate going to just bombers and submarines, and we get rid of the ICBM leg of the triad. What instabilities might arise, and how would Russia react to the United States basically reducing our strategic nuclear delivery vehicles from 700 to 300? And as General Hyten has pointed out, reduce the number of assets that someone would have to target to from 500 to basically around 10. Could you address that, Mark?
Well, they would love it. Simplify in a very serious way the possibility of effective preemptive nuclear strikes that would take out most of our nuclear capability and could take out our national command authority. I believe the triad is an essential base for deterrence. We need a strategic triad, and I would take it one step further. We need a non-strategic triad, and we don't have that today, where the Russians do. They have many tactical or non-strategic nuclear weapons of every category. They have land-based, sea-based, air-based, we're left with until we get the B-61 Mod 12 into the inventory. That's I think a few years away. We have a 1960 vintage gravity bomb, a 1980 vintage the 80 vintage bomb is strategic, not non-strategic, but that's it. Air Force Magazine, the latest issue, published a statement by the Air Force Association, and it talked about the need to modernize our fighter aircraft. It pointed out the average age of a fighter aircraft is 28 years, and most of them can't penetrate modern defenses. If you rephrase that and talked about our nuclear capable fighter force, you would say that the average age is about the same, 28 years, but none of them can penetrate modern defenses. And that won't change until the F-35 comes on board with the nuclear capability. And by the way, their version of a stealth aircraft, the Su-57, I don't really believe it's a true stealth aircraft. It's not fifth generation, really. But it's going to carry a hypersonic missile, probably almost certainly nuclear capable, and with a range of over 1,000 kilometers, be my guess, based on the physical size of it compared to the Kinzhal. And it's going to be carried internally. So you're going to have, and that missile, according to a recent Russian press report, is going to be suddenly appear on a whole bunch of other Russian non-strategic aircraft, fighters and attack aircraft. So we're going to have a much more capable Russian non-strategic force, and major elements of that force will literally be capable of strategic as well as non-strategic use. The announced range on some of their cruise missiles is now 4,000 kilometers with nuclear warheads on them. And, according to one Russian admiral, vice commander of the Russian Navy at the time, low yield nuclear warheads.
Let me ask you a question on, you mentioned it earlier about what General Hyten described as the Putin doctrine of escalate to win. Others have called it escalate to end a conflict on their terms. Others have criticized that assessment and said, no, it's Russia just wants to manage the escalatory ladder called escalation dominance. And it's been a long time concern of ours that if, God forbid, nuclear weapons are ever used, you'd want to be able to stop a fight before it gets out of hand. Could you address the little bit more on the criticism that it's really nothing new, that it's a defensive position of the Russians, that escalate to win doesn't really have any offensive characteristic in mind?
That view is literally head in the sand thinking. The escalate to de-escalate doctrine got a lot of publicity. I mean, before 2015, you find it in professional literature. A handful of experts worldwide were pointing this out and going back about 20 years. In 2015, the Obama administration at the most senior level started talking about this and pointing out how dangerous it is. Deputy Secretary of Defense, Vice Chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff said it was playing with fire. And that's exactly what it is. You will find that in publications by the Defense Science Board in the Obama administration, the National Intelligence Council of the Obama administration. This is not really debatable. It's there. You can go out and find it in the literature. They practice this in their exercises, as a director of the Defense Intelligence Agency stated in 2017. This is real, and it's not defensive in the sense that despite their paranoia, they know full well that NATO is not going to attack them, and they are threatening NATO across the board. They're large theater exercises, ZAPAD, and there'll be another version of ZAPAD this year, go nuclear, reportedly 100% of the time. They see nuclear weapons as one of their ace cards. Since 2007, when they started making overt nuclear threats, it's probably something on the order of 30 or 40 statements by the most senior Russian government officials, including the presidents of Russia, both of them, about using nuclear weapons and nuclear escalation. Attacking specific targets with them. This doesn't go on anywhere outside of Russia. Well, maybe one exception, North Korea, but that's sort of a crazy state in itself. The leadership there are pretty wild. But certainly among major European states, Russia is the only country that talks about nuclear first use, that threatens targeting, that generals make statements about targeting specific targets in NATO states. Russian ambassadors make statements about targeting specific targets in NATO states with nuclear weapons. It's amazing. The Orthodox Church has views on nuclear warfare, nuclear deterrence that are fundamentally different from any other religious body in the world. It's, I mean, some of it's absolutely amazing.
Thank you, Mark. I have another question, and that is, given your emphasis, and I think it's a correct one, that we should do everything possible to prevent the Russians from thinking that they can use nuclear weapons and be successful in whatever their objectives are, what would you recommend to the Biden administration in terms of adopting policies either consistent with the past two, three administrations or something new? What would you recommend that they do in order to ensure that the Russians don't think that they can use nuclear weapons in a conflict or in a crisis and be successful in so doing?
Well, certainly, number one, don't cut or eliminate elements of the modernization program that's underway. It's actually the Obama administration program. There were no real changes to the strategic triad in the 2018 nuclear posture review. You know, continue certainly keep deployed the small number of low yield Trident weapons. You know, go on with the development of the nuclear submarine launch cruise missile, and if anything, accelerate it. We need to move away from a monad. That's what we have in the sub-strategic or non-strategic area right now. All we got is gravity bombs. We have the strategic low yield Trident, but that's a strategic weapon. The Russians, by the way, have that too. That appeared initially in state media 12 years ago. And it's quite possible, based on a number of statements by their officials and reports in the state media, that every new design Russian nuclear weapon since the end of the Cold War has a low yield option on it. And unlike our nuclear low yield nuclear Trident, which really isn't a low yield weapon, it's just much lower than the large yield strategic weapons. These are true low yield. I mean, state media says you're talking about yields and 50 to 200 tons of yield. These are real low yield weapons, and the possibility that they will be used, I think, is very high if Putin initiates a war against the NATO state. And the objective will be to try to get the United States and NATO to back down, accept the Russian aggression. If that were to actually happen, it would be a catastrophe for Western civilization, to put it mildly. NATO would effectively be destroyed if it allowed any of its territory to be absorbed by military force by the Russian Federation. So, real bottom line, I would suggest that they take both the Russian and the Chinese nuclear threat very seriously. Chinese, by the way, are now telling us through Global Times, which is their main English language mouthpiece of the Communist Party of China, that we are substantially underestimating their nuclear capability. A recent article, this was by the chief editor of their publication, said they had 1,000 nuclear weapons, which is a lot compared to what we've got today, and certainly in terms of our active inventory.
Well, thank you, Mark. I want to thank you for the Q&A answers. We're going to go to our audience, but before we do, as an alert to our listeners, our next event is Tuesday, March 16th, when the Mitchell Institute will be hosting a panel on augmented reality. We hope all of you can join us for that. And we're now going to go to our audience for questions. You can participate in the Q&A by using the raise hand function on your device, or as some of you have done on the Q&A section, you've written a question to be asked, which I'm going to go ahead and refer to Mark. And one of the questions Mark was asked this is, aren't we exaggerating modernization in that it's not just, you're not just including every tweak or upgrade to a system, but you're talking about a new system when you talk about Russian modernization. Could you explain a little bit more of how you define that and why you think that's significant and it's not just a minor upgrade to an existing program?
Well, actually, it's just the opposite. Most of the 2025 systems we're talking about are clearly new by any definition of what constitutes new. They were not in existence when the Soviet Union died. They are things that the Soviets, some cases developing, some cases well beyond what the Soviets were developing in the last years of the Soviet Union. I mean, the only systems that we're talking about that would be characterized as a upgrade of existing systems in the missile category, it's the Sinov and Liner, which are major updates of the SSN-23 with two and a half times as many warhead capabilities, as well as various upgrades. When they don't do life extension, when they do what we would call life extension, it's really an upgrade in the military capabilities. The Tu-160M2 is a major upgrade of the bomber, more important than even the electronics and the new capabilities they're putting in it are the missiles that it carries. There are now at least three types of nuclear-armed or nuclear-capable air-launched cruise missiles that have been already introduced into the Russian Air Force to be carried by these bombers, including the new ones. Hypersonic missiles, they're in the process of deploying the Kinzhal, which is the aeroballistic missile, maneuvering ballistic missile capability, the smaller version of the Kinzhal that will be carried by more of the fighters. That one, according to a very recent Russian press report, will be start testing in 2023. As of now, there is not, certainly there is no announced US program for a nuclear capable hypersonic missile. And I don't believe there's any black program around anywhere trying to do that. So they're gonna have a monopoly on these sorts of capabilities and they're gonna get better and better. They're already claimed they have Mach 9 capabilities on the Zircon powered cruise missile. The Kinzhal is in the Mach 10 or Mach 10 plus speed category. U.S. defensive capabilities against these are either non-existent or almost non-existent right now. We need to do something about this as quickly as we can. There's no reason why we can't have capabilities against hypersonic missiles. It's just that we didn't give it the money because it wasn't a priority. Because we, until very fairly recently, we basically pretended that there weren't any Russian hypersonic programs underway. Now we know that they not only exist, but they're big time things and they're getting better.
Let me turn, Mark, now to my friend, David Anhalt, who I was going to relate his question, but David, why don't you go ahead? I know it's a multi-part question dealing with, in part, command, control, and communication, and why don't you ask Mark your question, and thank you for participating.
Okay, thank you very much, and Dr. Schneider. This is where I'm headed with this. You described this massive program for developing new nuclear weapons of many different types, many different platforms, many different ranges, far exceeding what the paint box had during the Cold War. Could you describe, outside of the scope of the weapons themselves, but the modernization of Russian nuclear command and control for the deployment of this vast armada, in particular, How is the Russian nuclear, modern Russian nuclear command and control different than the old Cold War type? I mean, for instance, has Putin delegated decisions for escalating to nuclear war to Russian generals or Russian colonels? I mean, what characterizes this modern nuclear command and control that must be more splendiferous than what the old Cold War version was? Over.
Thank you. Well, it's similar in many respects to the old Soviet system, but much more modern. They are engaged in the construction of a new generation of ultra deep, ultra hard bunkers. Putin, in the 2020 Sochi meetings, and they have an annual meeting for the last 15 years where they talk about their you know, military modernization capabilities. This time it was very unusual. The only public announced things that were said at Sochi related to the strategic nuclear forces and to nuclear command and control. Putin spent one day in terms of the open part of the meeting. Obviously, there were not, you know, most of the meetings were closed, but he talked about their new nuclear bomb-proof bunker system that was just about operational. And there have been statements about these in some of the earlier versions of the annual report by the intelligence community going back almost 10 years. This is very credible. And Bill Gertz has written several articles where he's talked about the new bunker construction program. So they have built the system, which in a practical sense is basically virtually impossible to attack with any real reliability. We don't have the weapons capability to do it. We're not developing a weapon that's optimized for attacking these type of facilities. The perimeter system or dead hand, it's sometimes called, is almost certainly, I believe, still operational. I don't believe it's particularly sinister in the sense. The descriptions of it you find in Russian open sources is one where it will function only if the central government is taken out, the military, and all the bunkers. It's not something that's automatic. It's something that can be stopped if it were to, you know, accidentally activate. And I think the chances of accidental activation are pretty low. So the fundamental difference is they take nuclear war seriously. We don't. Everything in the U.S. depends on getting the president out of Washington and out of a nuclear blast area before the weapons get here. The problem with that, with the new hypersonic missiles, is you may have as little as 5 minutes warning time. Before you start getting nuclear detonations in Washington. We have a very, very serious nuclear command and control problem. I think it's one of the things we really need to do something about. You don't want them to believe that they can do a preemptive strike and take out the National Command Authority. In 2019, Vladimir Putin made a reference to preemptive attacks on the president. He urged the US government to look at the timelines. He didn't elaborate, but the Russian press the next day immediately elaborated and talked about preemptive attacks with hypersonic nuclear missiles against the National Command Authority. And then the general, the Army Gerasimov, chief of the general staff, made a very explicit statement about attacking command and control, National Command and Control. And the only way to do that, of course, is with nuclear weapons. Our experience with taking out Saddam Hussein is conventional weapons don't work very much in this sort of objective. You really do need a nuclear capability if you're going to try to take out the government. So I think we need to try to enhance the nuclear command and control. We've got to do something about the EMP vulnerability we've allowed to develop. There's some indications the Air Force is really now taking that seriously and going ahead with upgrades on EMP vulnerability. And I very strongly support that. It's long overdue.
Let me go to Tom Neubauer, who also has a question. Tom, welcome to the seminar. Let's hear what your question is.
Actually, Peter, I don't actually have a question, but I appreciate you seeing my hand up.
Okay.
Our last caller addressed that very well. Thanks.
Okay. Well, thank you, Tom. Mark, we did have one other question came in, and what is the Russian view of the Chinese nuclear capability? How much does that factor into what the Russians are doing today?
Going back 20 years, you can find Russian military officers, most of this is at the 05, 06 level, talking about the size of the Chinese nuclear capability and putting it at levels that are much higher than normal Western estimates time period. I think it's clear they take the Chinese nuclear threat very seriously. However, and this is a very big, you know, footnote, it's not politically correct in Russia to say that. So they have to hide that perception. If you talk to them on the margins of conferences where they attend, and they know you and privately, they'll admit that they're concerned about Chinese capability, but they won't say it in public. They're even taking actions to augment, to some degree anyway, the Chinese nuclear capability. Viktor Mikhailov, he's now deceased, but he was chief the minister for atomic energy in Russia. He was, after that, he was director of the Sarov nuclear weapons laboratory. Used to have a website up and personal website, and he has a picture of a gold medal awarded to him by China. And he bragged that it had 87.5 grams of pure gold in it. Now, he didn't get that for nothing. So there are reports that Mikhailov was involved in nuclear illegal in the sense of, from a Russian government standpoint, transfer of data from the Russian nuclear weapons establishment to the Chinese nuclear weapons establishment. And there are rumors that his firing and demotion, firing lasted 1 week and he was reinstated, but he was reinstated one level lower as principal head of the atomic energy ministry. There are rumors in Russian press that was over transfer of nuclear weapons related information to the Chinese. And there are reports of technology transfer to the Chinese relating to strategic missile systems. I mean, this is not an enormous body of literature. It's pretty small, actually. But I think it's reasonably credible.
Mark, I want to thank you. Come to the end of this nuclear deterrent series seminar. A big thanks again to you, sir, and to our audience, and from all of us here at the Mitchell Institute. I want to urge you all to have a great aerospace day. Again, Mark, thank you very much. And I want to particularly thank our staff here at the Mitchell Institute that helped make these possible. They do great work, and want to thank them for all the work they do. And again, Mark, thank you for this, and thank you, everybody. Take care.